Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I am thrilled to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week a teacher from Gaza City speaking to us from Gaza, one of the contributors to a wonderful book called Gaza Writes Back, Short Stories from Young Writers in Gaza, Palestine. Her name is Sarah Ali. Sarah, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Things are again horrific in Gaza. Tell us where you live and what you're experiencing.
I live in the northern of Gaza, a city, small city called Jabalia. Well, I can't really describe things in here. It's horrible. There is bombing. I hear bombing every 5, 6, 7 minutes. My house keeps shaking, although it's like our area is relatively safer than other places. However, it's continuous bombing from ground, from the sea, from gunboats, and from airstrikes as well.
Really? You're being fired upon from boats and from planes and from...
From gunboats, from airstrikes, and from ground. Ground shelling is limited to east and north Gaza, however.
And you're hearing this every 5 or 10 minutes?
Yeah, almost.
You wrote an article I saw that was posted on Al Jazeera, and you mentioned also seeing drones in the sky.
Yes, drones, this is something like we are used to in Gaza. Like, even when there is no specific attack, there are always surveillance drones in Gaza sky, and they intensify at night.
And these are Israeli military drones?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
You are a teacher. Are you able to teach? Is school going on?
No. Most workplaces are closed. Universities are closed. Schools are closed. I teach in an American organization, but it's closed as well, except for journalists and medical staff. People don't really go out, except for, like, getting food or shopping in general, but mostly people stay indoors.
And this has been for how many days now?
Now it's the 17th.
17 days, and I should say we are recording this on Wednesday the 23rd. What are conditions like in terms of electricity, water, basic utilities?
I think it depends on the area where you live. I live in North Gaza. Even North Gaza has three main cities, Beit Lahia, Beit Hanun, and Jabalia. Where I live, Jabalia, we have 6 hours of electricity and then 12 hours off. Some other areas where it's really bad, they have 2 hours only per day because the main power plant was, again, bombed by Israeli forces. So this is for electricity. Of course, when there's a long blackout, water finishes as well, so we have to figure out ways to fill out our water tanks. But this is how it is. In southern Gaza, I think they have from 6 to 8 power electricity per day, and then it's off again.
I saw a story just today about Israeli strikes at what was described as the only power plant in Gaza. Were that to be destroyed, would that eliminate your electricity?
Yes. I think they bombed part of it. This is why in my area, we still have electricity. But I believe it's like if the whole place is bombed, nobody would be able to have electricity in Gaza.
You wrote in your article about just about every type of person and civilian being targeted. They are targeting fishermen and farmers and children. Have you seen this? Have you heard stories?
Of course. I lost two friends just in this attack. I lost two friends I knew. I lost my neighbor. He's not even a journalist. He's a driver. Like he drives journalists to sites where they can cover news. He was bombed. Like their car. He was driving a car. And the car had a giant red sticker on it with TV written on the hook, and they still bombed it. So no one is safe. Why would they bomb a car driving in the streets with and clearly having civilians, only civilians doing their work, journalists and a driver.
There have been stories of threats to journalists, and there was an attack on the offices of Al Jazeera in Gaza. Do you think that attack on your friend was random or intentionally targeting a journalist?
I can't predict, to be honest, but I believe there's been a systematic attack on journalists and reporters in general, because and this is part of why they hit the power plant, because then we would lose electricity and then we would lose our internet access, which means less reporters, less people on the ground reporting about airstrikes and about bombing. So I think they're trying to win the conflict through social media, but I still believe that a lot of people are doing wonderful job reporting from here, whether Palestinians or internationals.
They are indeed, and I very much appreciate you speaking with us. You wrote that your grandparents are deceased, but their home, which was being lived in, I guess, by many of your relatives, was targeted, and was targeted without the so-called warning phone call. Can you describe what that means and what happened?
It was on the 16th of July. Usually, like when there's a recorded message, which almost all people in Gaza get. You know, we got it in my house. It's a recorded message telling you to evacuate your home if you're living in northern Gaza, if you're living in southern Gaza. And the funny thing is they keep calling everyone, like, if everyone has to evacuate, where should we go? The only place left to go to is the sea. But this recorded message is usually ignored by people because it's the same message everyone gets. However, some houses get, like, a specific message that your house is now going to bomb. You have 5 minutes to evacuate. And in those cases, people try to run, to gather whatever they can, to have their kids out, and then the house is destroyed. My cousins did not even have that. They had a missile, which they call a warning missile, which, by the way, is the one by which my aunt was injured. It's not a warning missile if it injures people. It can kill people. And then maybe 2-3 minutes later, the real bomb fell and destroyed the house. It was leveled to the ground. It was a two-story house. 4 families lived there, and it was destroyed.
And how many people were injured?
2, only 2. Miraculously, they survived. My aunt and my uncle were injured, but they are all fine now.
And where will all of these people live now?
In relatives' homes. That's the sad part. They have nowhere to go. So fortunately, family ties in Gaza are strong, but you can't live in someone else's house forever. They are now set into their relatives' homes. Each family is taking shelter in their relatives' home, but that's it for now.
I've read that there are hundreds of thousands of people living in makeshift shelters without actual homes at this point. Is that accurate as far as you know?
In shelters?
In temporary shelters of some kind.
It's actually UN schools, UNRWA schools. I'm not sure about the number, to be honest, but I think hundreds of thousands of people have taken shelter in UN schools. Because they believe it's safer. Although in Camp Ready 2008-2009, an honorary school was attacked as well. But a lot of people, especially in northern Gaza, from Beit Lahia and Beit Hanun, they were told to evacuate. So they left their homes and they are living in temporary shelters in UN schools. They have turned classrooms into shelters.
As you may know, in the United States, our television news and newspapers are telling us quite a lot about Hamas and Hamas rockets and the provocation of Israeli defense of Israel and so forth. This is the way that this story is presented. What do people in Gaza, yourself and those you know, think of Hamas and think of firing rockets into Israel?
I think people have different opinions about this, but I believe with the increase of the dust tail, the death toll, and the more people, the more Palestinians Israel kills, I'm noticing that the support for armed resistance in Gaza is increasing. You can't besiege people, bomb them continuously, kill them, and then expect them to not fight back. I noticed a lot of people who were otherwise very critical of Hamas and its ideology are now becoming very supportive of rockets, and that makes sense. When a besieged and defenseless population is being bombed 24 hours, they have the right to defend themselves. And I don't know, I think a lot of American leaders and, you know, the U.S. media in general is quite one-sided. It presents us as terrorists, while Israel has the right to defend itself. Well, the last time there was a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel, Hamas stuck to the ceasefire for almost 3 months. Zero rockets were fired, while Israel attacked literally hundreds of times. So I think last time there was a ceasefire, or the ceasefire after the 2012 attack. I can't remember the name anyway. So the 2012 attack by Israel, Operation the Pillar of Defense, was the ceasefire was broken 2 days after it was signed by Israel. Of course, a man was shot by live bullets in Gaza, near the border between Gaza and Israel. So I think people are becoming do not really trust Israel. Are becoming more frustrated with the PA, the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah. So I believe a lot of people do support rockets because only as a reaction to what Israel is doing. Besides, I believe personally, rockets have hurt almost no one in Israel. And personally, I wish no Israeli civilian any harm. But I think if the most we could do is disrupt the normality of life in Israel, then I believe that is what we should do.
It seems that from the point of view of Israel, if to the extent that anyone there actually wants to stop the rockets, what you're describing is that their attack on Gaza is entirely counterproductive. It is encouraging support for Hamas.
Exactly.
And yet,
and, like I'm telling you, I've always been critical of Hamas, but when you see that they are the only ones fighting now for us, and they are the only ones fighting back, then we have no other choice. The more you oppress people, the more you bomb them, the more angry they will become.
And yet, seen from afar, from a safe home where I am, the rockets fired by Hamas seem entirely counterproductive as well, because they give Israel an excuse. They change the story. They allow international organizations and nations to depict Gaza as the aggressor and Israel as the defender, and militarily they seem incredibly ineffective. So it seems to be counterproductive action from both sides. One side, of course, much more serious than the other, and building on an ongoing illegal occupation and blockade. But isn't it counterproductive to be sending the rockets?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm not really sure. But I believe that if people in Israel experience at least some of what we go through on a daily basis, I believe a lot of them would pressure their government. Something else is that a lot of people who are under rocket fire, although that sounds funny because they have shelters, a lot of are protesting Israel's actions. A couple of days ago, there was a protest in Tel Aviv, and the protesters, unfortunately, have been hit by right-wing Israelis, but they are protesting because of the rocket. So I believe it might be counterproductive in terms of how it changes the narrative in mainstream media, because people start blaming Hamas. But generally, like people here are fed up with being the victims and with being to blame as well. Like, you can't blame Hamas every time Israel kills civilians. It just doesn't make sense. If Israel claims to be defending itself, it can't kill civilians and defend itself. It's horrible.
The most horrible part, from our point of view, these thousands of miles away, is that many of the weapons Israel is using are provided free of cost by the U.S. government, and that the United States government routinely serves as a protector of Israel from any legal consequences for its actions. What do people in Gaza think of the United States government and the U.S. weapons that Israel is openly using against them?
I think most of us here believe that the U.S. government, the Obama administration, are hypocrites. I believe they have double standards. Like, when the U.S. State Department spokeswoman spoke about how Israel has the right to defend itself, one of us interrupted and started asking, how about Palestinians? Do they have the right to defend themselves? And she kept... She kept escaping from answering the question. And rather than saying that, yes, they do have the right to defend themselves, she just kept repeating that Hamas are terrorists. Well, not everyone in Gaza is Hamas. It doesn't give Israel the right to bomb civilians. So I believe it's partly the fault of Obama. It's hugely his fault. Because I believe if the U.S. Stopped providing Israel with weapons, that would make a huge change. People in America, I have friends from America who are not happy about their tax money going to weapons. So I believe it's really hypocritical of Western leaders in general to keep staunchly asserting Israel's right to defend itself while mainly civilian population, the majority of whom are children, have no right to defend themselves. Like, what kind of double standards are these?
Well, I hope that that you and your neighbors and your family members are aware that many of us, and a growing number of us in the United States, agree with you entirely and are protesting the U.S. government's role and the Israeli government's actions in this matter. We've been speaking with Sarah Ali, who is in Gaza and who is a contributor to a terrific book called Gaza Writes Back, Short Stories from Young Writers in Gaza, Palestine. Sarah has given me permission to read her story to you. The Story of the Land by Sarah Ali, to Dad. I looked at his teary eyes, and beholding something akin to happiness, I smiled. The man I have always known to be my father was back. He did not look like that unfamiliar man whom I could not fully recognize during the last 3 years. He was no longer that absent-minded, silent figure gazing at walls all the time and uninterestingly nodding whenever addressed by anyone at home. He was there. He was present. He was actually listening as I went on bragging about a high grade of mine. A phone call and a piece of paper signed by some Turkish-sponsored institution brought back my father. I looked at his eyes again, this time more carefully for fear that my first glance was false. As I saw that absolute happiness in my father's eyes, a big smile made it to my face again. As we now commemorate the Land Day, we honor the people who stood up for their land in 1976 when Israel announced thousands of Palestinian dunams would be confiscated. During marches held to protest that declaration, 6 people were killed. The 30th of March brings back a memory of our land, my father's land. A couple weeks ago, we got a phone call informing us that my father's name had been selected for a reconstruction program funded by Turkey. The program aims at helping Gazan farmers whose lands were damaged during the Israeli offensive in 2008 to replant their trees. It provides farmers with all types of facilitating materials, such as fences, tree cuttings, seedlings, seeds, and irrigation systems. My father declined to apply for those organizations that give financial compensation to farmers. How can he take money in return for land? Unlike any other aid program, this program gives no money to farmers. It instead helps them stand on their own. Though my father was born to a family of farmers, he did not follow that path. He studied economics and political science in Egypt and spent most of his youth working as a journalist, mainly a columnist, writing about economic and political issues in newspapers in Kuwait. When he was back in Gaza, though, he had to take care of the piece of land my grandfather left for him years before. It was not difficult for him. Gradually, the land became more of a passion than a profession. It was one of the few things he cared about, the daily thing that kept him busy. It was heaven on earth. During those 23 days of the Israeli attack on Gaza, we were constantly receiving news of land being run over by Israeli bulldozers. We were told thousands of trees were gone. We were told my uncle's trees were gone. We were told our trees were gone. We were told Sharga, the whole district of eastern farmland, was gone. But these were rumors, or so my father wanted to believe. We all had hope that our land was still intact, totally untouched. We were clinging to the assumption that only other people's trees could get uprooted, but certainly not our beautiful, unmatched olives. Certainly not the trees that were, to my father, the only thing he boasted of to prove he was no less of a Gazan than those who repeatedly reproached him for, as they put it, recklessly leaving the land of black gold, where they assumed he swam in Kuwaiti oil pools every day, and for coming to live here, with a small h. My father looked at it quite differently, for here, he always believed, is the land of Al Zayt Al Mukaddas, the holy oil. Gaza's sky was blue again. Things were over. The news said things were over. My father went there. He went to check up on the land. He put his faith in his olives being an exception, and he went there. He put his faith in that little white spot in the heart of the bulldozer's operator, who my father supposed could not have resisted the beauty of our land, and who listened to his innate good being that told him not to run over this land. He had faith in the goodness of man, and he went there. He put his faith in God, and he went there. My brother, who accompanied him, told us later that all they saw as they walked was ruined lands filled with bulldozed dead trees, which seemed to suffice for the family's need of firewood for years to come. My father said Dad started crying as he saw people crying. They went on. They saw more toppled trees, feeble and defeated. They went on. There was the heaven. The scene of our land was not shocking. Simply put, our trees were no exception. Our trees were gone. A miscellany of affliction and denial took over the place. My father's faith, I could tell, was smashed into little pieces. The world seemed like an ugly place. One of our trees, which later became the subject matter the whole neighborhood spoke of, was still standing there. Just 1 week before the attacks, my father told my brother how slanted this tree was and how quickly they needed to get rid of it. They were planning to cut it, and yet, ironically, it was the only tree the Israeli army left. Out of boredom or out of mercy, I cannot tell, but it was still there. Later, whenever my cousins wanted to make Dad feel less terrible about it, they made fun of the whole thing. How the hell did the soldiers know you were planning to cut it anyway and so decided not to cut it themselves? My cousins would remark. Everyone would start laughing, but Dad did not. His land and olive groves are not laughing matters to him. When my father and brother were home that day, my brother started telling us about what he saw. He told us that the trees were uprooted. Al-Shajar Charaf. He kept repeating. My father was in his room crying. During the weeks that followed my father's visit to the land, he had a daily schedule. In the morning, he prayed and read Quran. At night, he cried. Speaking about the land, the houses, and generally the financial losses during or right after the Israeli offensive would have sounded very selfish and indifferent to others. When people are dying, you do not speak of your beautiful house that was leveled to the ground. When people are losing their legs and arms, leaving them disabled for the rest of their lives, you do not speak of your fancy car that once looked like a vase adorning the streets of your modest neighborhood and that is now a gray wreck. When a mother is burying her child before she could say goodbye, you do not speak of your land and your trees that were mercilessly uprooted. Those people speak. They cry. They mourn. You listen. And for the memory of your insignificant little misery, you grieve in silence. And that seemed to have amassed more agony over Dad's pain. Recently, I went to Father to get accurate information about the trees that were uprooted, their numbers, and their age. Why are you asking? Are you applying for one of those charity institutions that offer some money and a bag of flour instead of helping people plant their trees again? Are you? We do not need those. The guy I met from the reconstruction program called last week, and they already sent laborers and farmers to start their job. Do you still want to apply for charity? No, Baba. I am just writing something for my blog. Blog, okay, whatever that is. So how many trees were uprooted? 180 olive trees, I guess, and 189 olive trees, 160 lemon trees, 14 guava trees, he bellowed, angry that I missed the exact number. Embarrassed, I lowered my head and wondered why I was doing this to myself. My thoughts were interrupted when he went on. Next time you decide to do whatever it is that you want to do, right now, get your numbers straight. I made no reply. You hear me? There were 189 olive trees, not 180, not 181, not even 188, 189 olive trees. He left the room a few minutes afterwards. Guilt was all I could feel. That an Israeli soldier could bulldoze 189 olive trees on the land he claims is part of the God-given land is something I will never comprehend. Did he not consider the possibility that God might get angry? Did he not realize that it was a tree he was running over? If a Palestinian bulldozer were ever invented, haha, I know, and I were given the chance to be in an orchard, in Haifa, for instance, I would never uproot a tree an Israeli planted. No Palestinian would. To Palestinians, the tree is sacred, and so is the land bearing it. And as I talk about Gaza, I remember that Gaza is but a little part of Palestine. I remember that Palestine is bigger than Gaza. Palestine is the West Bank. Palestine is Ramallah. Palestine is Nablus. Palestine is Jenin. Palestine is Tulkarm. Palestine is Bethlehem. Palestine, most importantly, is Jaffa and Haifa and Acre and all those cities that Israel wants us to forget about. Today I came to realize that it was not the phone call that brought my father back, nor was it the paper signed by the aid institution. It was the memory of the land being revived that brought him back. It was the memory of olive trees giving that sense of security each time he sat under them, enjoying their shade and dodging the burning rays of the sun. It was the memory of the golden oil, the best and purest oil, being poured into jerry cans and handed to family and friends as precious gifts. It was the memory of long years of cherishing the land, years of giving and belonging. Between my father and his land is an unbreakable bond. Between Palestinians and their land is an unbreakable bond. By uprooting plants and cutting trees continually, Israel tries to break that bond and impose its own rules of despair on Palestinians. By replanting their trees over and over again, Palestinians are rejecting Israel's rules. My land, my rules, says Dad. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.